if Wade has asked whether I would consider a take-home final, the answer is I will consider it. I'm not going to have an answer on this by tomorrow.
Sorry, you're
looking for a car. And it turns out tomorrow is going to be the last day of class because I'm going to be in New York Wednesday morning. I'm going to ask Swaroop to take the time to be here Wednesday. I understand there were some difficulties with his lecture. I'm going to ask him to come because I want you to have the opportunity to ask him any questions that you may have. At least the people who were here seemed to find that in their more direct discussions with him, they were able to communicate successfully. Also, I'm very thankful that only one person has proposed a review topic because it means obviously we don't need to review. We can't. All right. I want to continue the microphone topic and wrap it up. And actually, in light of a discussion I've been having, I actually don't really want to focus on the microphone per se. I want to show you some things about it. I want to talk about what it permits. And because what it permits is controversial. And it has two edges, some good, some bad, one good, one bad. And I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows, how to eliminate one feature without eliminating the other feature, and that's the source of the controversy. So I talked Friday about L4. And I noted that the key features of L4 were IPC and map and unmap. And I didn't go into a lot of detail about the system call interface, but I said that there weren't very many. And that most of them were pretty machine specific. Unmap is a system call, IPC is a system call. There are one or two others, but nothing you could look at and say, oh, that's hugely exciting. Get my cast idea is a system call, I'm not 100% sure about that. And that's pretty much it. And I said that even the L4 community agrees that they needed a mechanism that was sort of fast enough for protected IPC. They had a mechanism in L4 called Clans and Chiefs that could do protection. But it did so at a significant overhead. The mechanism required that for every actual IPC between two parties that was to be protected, there would have to be two additional IPCs, right? So the only way that I would get to go to you is I'd go to my chief would go to your chief, and your chief would talk to you. So it's a 3-to-1 multiplier, and that's actually quite expensive. And I talked about how in L4SEC, part of what's being contemplated, and may at this point be operational, I don't know, is that they would map task names so that instead of sending a task, I would send them my mapping for a task. And this has the effect of adding protection because if I don't have the mapping, I can't send the task. Eros works a little differently. So in Eros, the concept is that there are lots of resources in the system, maybe processes, maybe address spaces, maybe pages, and every one of these resources has one or more capabilities that name it. The capability is a descriptor. It's a kernel-protected data structure. And what it contains is the identity, if you like, the address of the resource, and some additional permission information. It is not a metric. It's a value. So, in contrast to the L4 model, where the mappings of the thread space are the source of authority, in the Eros model, there is a capability address space, which we refer to as C-space, and actually I've described a hybrid of the Eros model and its successor, and I'm not going to try to figure out which one's which. And just like in data space, the slots of the address space hold bytes. In the Eros-Kionis model, the slots of the address space hold capabilities. Now, these are not cryptographic. be protected. These are protected by an operating system. You only get to use one of these things by making a system call, and the operating system is going to act on your behalf, assuming you have the necessary capability. In Aris or in Coyotes, there's really only one system call. Although it has, again, this is the joke, right? You can build a machine with one instruction, it just has to have lots and lots of variations. You could argue maybe that there were three in the original system, but they're all very, very closely related. So in Aris, all resources, and that includes some basic services implemented by the kernel. Everything is named by a capability. A capability is the only mechanism to request an operation of any sort. So, there is an operation that corresponds closely to the IPC operation, which is the invoke capability operation. Okay, so the way in Aris you do an IPC is you invoke a capability, namely something called a start capability. Start capability is the thing that allows you to send a message to an application that's running in some other process. Now, the reason I emphasize the to an application part is there's another kind of capability called a process capability. And you can have a process capability and a start capability, both of which name the same process in terms of physical data structure. When I send a message to the process capability, I'm asking for a request that has to do with the process abstraction. Get register, start, stop, something like this. When I send a message to the start capability, I am sending a message to the application whose code the process obeys. So this jump from the process layer abstraction to the application layer abstraction, Wade, you'll want to listen to the first few minutes of the tape because I answered your question before you walked in. This jump from the process abstraction to the application abstraction, this is the place where the system becomes extensible. It's the place that allows the user to add services using the capability-based naming mechanism that were not previously in the system. The mapping mechanism in Aris is a hierarchical mapping mechanism. So, in contrast to L4 map, where I can send a flex region, there's a 2 to the k byte region that's 2 to the k byte long. In Aris, I send a capability. So, I have to have in my address space tree some route that points to some mapping structure. And I'm going to send you, you're the recipient, a copy of this capability, which you're going to put in your space. Now, actually, those two operations are very similar. One of the changes that we're making in Coyotes is there are some restrictions on the way that the Aris node structure works. And the effect of those restrictions is that those capabilities that point to a node, which is basically the mapping structure, have to be at a 32 power k page boundary. Why? Because nodes are 32 slots wide, so effectively it's a 32 area tree. So, strictly speaking, we can't send a flex region because we can't get down to an arbitrary power of 2. The next generation of this system, I don't know if we're going to do it, but we at least have a design and a data structure that lets us express something very, very close to what the L4 design can express. And there are good reasons to want to be able to express it. It doesn't matter what power of 2 you choose. If it's not an arbitrary power of 2, there turn out to be mappings that you really want to be able to build that are just pragmatically inconvenient to build. I don't know if we're actually going to use that mechanism, but I at least want to play with it. The difference is that this is a copy. It's not a map operation. So this transfer capability, right, is I'm handing you a capability that is co-equal in all respects to the one that I held. I do not retain the right to revoke this capability. So there's no unnet operation. This is a subtle point. But remember I said, if A maps to B, maps to C, maps to D, then any of A or B or C can cause D's capability to cease working. And furthermore, there's no mechanism in L4 to actually check against that. You lost? Mm-hmm. Maybe you're shaking your head?
Yeah.
Okay. You were actually shaking your head by that. Now, there is a structurally similar mechanism in the Arrested Coyotes design. So this is a delicate sort of argument about architecture, and I want to make it careful. There is something called a wrapper. This is a kernel-implemented object, and it holds a capability to something, which might be an address space. And the client holds a capability to the wrapper, and basically cannot tell that the original capability, almost cannot tell, certainly cannot tell by invoking the wrapper capability that the wrapper is present. What a wrapper does is it transparently forwards all messages to the capability that it wraps. Why would I want to do that? Well, because sometimes I do want to hand you an authority that you can use, but I can revoke. In a capability system, it is very expensive. In fact, nobody knows how to do it. Pretty much nobody knows how to do it. To revoke one capability to a resource. If a resource has 500 capabilities, it's very hard to say, I really only want to revoke this one. Generally speaking, what's easy to do is to revoke the entire object and thereby revoke all of the capabilities. That can be done with some kind of a counter. So the workaround is to say, well, look, if I know I'm going to hand you something that I want to revoke later, instead of handing you the capability directly, I should put a wrapper around it, I should hand you a wrapper, and then the way I will selectively revoke your access is I'll destroy the wrapper. And just to calibrate this, the wrapper in principle is about 40 bytes. It's pretty cheap. And which one of these mechanisms that you believe is primary has a lot to do with which of these relationships you believe is more common. Right? The one where you and I are co-equal and neither of us is going to revoke from the other, right? Or the one where your access is going to be conditional and I want to reserve the right to revoke it later. The observation is there are many reasons to subdivide applications into processes. Some of them have to do with security. Security boundaries are places where you tend to want to revoke. But some of them simply have to do with testing and robustness and structure. Right? These are places where you're doing subdivision for reasons of engineering, not for reasons of lack of trust. And the observation is in the Arrow system, there are more of these engineering boundaries than there are trust boundaries. So we observe that the wrapping pattern is actually not very often used in very idiomatic ways and in fairly unusual circumstances. But here's the second. As a client, as a recipient of a capability, if I receive a wrapper capability, I can determine that the object has been wrapped. So if you hand me something that you say, here is a source of storage, you can allocate pages from this. There is a test that I can perform, I'm going to describe the mechanism in a second, that says, this capability that I have, is it in fact a capability to an authentic storage server? Why do I care? Because an authentic storage server has a contract that I know some properties about, and these properties are very foundational in the design of the system. And the main one is, if I allocate a page from a storage allocator, I know that nobody else can get access to that page unless I give it to them. In particular, I know the storage allocator will not give it out. But that contract's only upheld if I actually know that I'm talking to an authentic storage allocator. One of the concerns in the capability system is that you can have a storage allocator, which we call a space backup, and it can be completely legitimate. And you could put an object in front of it that has a capability in the storage allocator. And instead of handing me a capability to the storage allocator, you could hand me a capability to your proxy object. Now, the capability, the FaceBank's contract about pages being unique, exclusively held at the time of allocation, which is the term that we use for this, does not comply with it. The space bank is still satisfying that contract. However, the capability that you hand to me may not. Because what your proxy can do is if they get a request that I make to the space bank, you can turn to the space bank, make the request, buy the objects in the expected way, completely honoring the protocol, hand me back a message that I cannot tell is any different from the response I would have gotten from the space bank, except, oh, by the way, on the side, it's keeping a copy of every capability that it allocates. And so I have lost my ability to get a guarantee that my storage is private to me. There are a lot of things that I lose if I can't establish that guarantee. So, system has a mechanism, and I'll describe the detail of this mechanism in a minute, where I can basically say, I have a capability, I have reason to believe, or I've been told that it should be a capability to a certain kind of a process. In this case, it's space data. Separately, I have a means to authenticate capabilities that actually are capabilities to that kind of process. And I can take the one capability and the second capability, and I can say, this capability that you handed me, is it actually a space bank capability? And I can get a yes or no response. And this means that in that scenario where A sends to B sends to C sends to D, D can get the capability, can authenticate it, and after authenticating it, D has independent means of knowing that that object is authentic. And then no further interaction on that object can be hazarded by the intermediaries. It's not quite true. If the capability that I receive conveys the authority to destroy the object, then the intermediaries could destroy the object. But they can't interfere with my actual interactions with the object except by destroying the object. It's a very heavyweight kind of action.
Okay, what's the mechanism here? Because this is actually kind of neat, and then I want to switch gears.
I should maybe say that the fundamental architectural purpose of the Eros architecture, the Kikos architecture before it, was to deal with situations of what may be called suspicious collaboration. You and I have to work together. We've got to get a problem solved. We trust each other in some limited sense, that we're willing to work together enough to collaborate, but we do not trust each other fully, and so we wish to collaborate in such a way that each of us can guard our interests from the other. That's actually a very tricky problem to solve. The foundation mechanism for solving that problem in Eros is something called the constructor. Okay? And the constructor is basically a utility program, very small program, and its job is to build new programs. So the way I get a new copy of LS, or its equivalent in Eros, is I go to the LS constructor, I say, instantiate for me a copy of the LS program, hand it these initial capabilities, and let it run. This is true in exactly the same way that in Unix you would say exactly slash bin slash LS image, except I don't have direct access to the bin LS image, only the constructor has that. What I have access to to as the constructor. I can't inspect the binary of the VNLS image unless VNLS, when running, agrees to permit me to inspect.
So the first job of the constructor is to instantiate processes. But the second job of the constructor is a bit more interesting.
I'm sorry, the second job is to hold private information. It's a bootstrapping issue, because once the information is disclosed, you can't take it back. The third operation of the constructor is the really interesting part. It's the certifying operation. It says, the question is, if whatever program you build, you the constructor, if I were to ask you to build one of those, and then I were to speak to it, would it be possible that this program would disclose my information to some other program in the system? That is, do I have a guarantee of privacy, ignoring covert channels? Now, this doesn't mean I have an absolute guarantee, right? If the program initially has privacy, then I hand it the ability to speak to you, potentially, depending on what the program does, I've lost my privacy. The point is that I get a chance not to hand it the ability to speak to you. If the initial condition is that my program should only have private communication with me. The constructor is actually able to answer this question and is able to do it without knowing what the program is.
So here's the test. What the constructor does is, as it's being fabricated, what's going on is that the developer says, I need a new constructor, and I'm going to install some capabilities into it. These capabilities are later going to be components of the program.
As each capability is installed, the constructor does a test on it. It's a kernel-implemented test. It's called the classify operation. And it's implemented by a capability that we call the script. And it classifies the capabilities into four categories. Tell you what they are.
So category one is capabilities that are trivially safe. For example, the descript capability itself is trivially safe. It doesn't really give you any power that you couldn't already get.
Errors are something called the number capability. It holds an 80-bit value. A number capability is trivially safe. There's nothing you can do with a number capability that lets you communicate to somebody else. Okay. So there's a very short list of about four or five capabilities that are considered trivially safe in this way.
Number two, is it transitively read-only?
So, if I hand you a read-only page, you can't write to that, and if you can't write to it, you can't communicate using it because you can't change its state. Now, why transitively?
Well, suppose the capability that I put in here is a capability to this node. That node, in turn, holds a capability to a page. Now, if the capability to the node itself is read-only, but not transitively read-only, and the capability to the page is read-write,
well, I can't transmit information through the node directly, but starting from the node, I can get my paws on something that I can use to transmit information by the transmit step. And the goal here is to make sure exactly that that's not possible, because the goal here is what's called confinement, the privacy problem.
So NRS is actually an additional access right, and it only applies to objects that hold capabilities. So there is something, there is read only, there is read write, these two are traditional. But there's also something called weak, which we abbreviate WK.
Here's the definition of weak. If I hold a weak capability, by the way, weak capability cannot allow write permission. Weak is more restrictive than read only. If I hold a weak capability, And using it, I fetch another capability.
For example, I fetch this page capability out of this node.
I won't get back the capability that was actually in the slot that I fetch. I will get back a transform one. The nature of the transform is that before the capability is returned to me that was in the slot, or that is before it's copied, it's going to be downgraded. Specifically, it's going to be downgraded, whatever it is, to a weak read-only version of whatever it is. So if this thing is a read-write page capability, and I fetch it through a weak capability, the capability I will get back is a weak page capability.
Weak capability lets me re-get it, does not let me read any capability that contains mutated code. Does not let me write it. Does not let me write capabilities.
Okay, so you can sort of see that it needs to be restricted our attention to memory-like objects. What we're actually going to get here, stepwise, is a transitive restriction. Because each of these fetches, in turn, is going to apply this weakened restriction. So the intuition is, if I start a traversal from a weak capability, there's no way I can ever obtain a capability that gives me authority to write. And that's what weak is for.
And there's a catch. You know, somebody might, out of perversity, store into this, or even out of good reasons, store into this node a process capability or a start capability. What do you do about those? How do you weaken those?
Well, the answer in general is, if the capability is a kernel-implemented object, we may be able to define the notion of a read-only version. In fact, for process capabilities, we don't. But if the capability we're weakening is a start capability, we have a problem. From the kernel perspective, we have no way to know what the program is that answers to that start capability. We don't know what application choice. So the weakening operation is conservative. It says, if I can't weaken it in some sort of small way, the answer is, return an invalid capability. Okay? So this is a very conservative, transitive read-only restriction. There are things you can't get through it at all, because the weaken of a start capability is an invalid capability. Mark Miller has been working on systems where I could maybe know something about the code and not have to go that far. But that's beyond what we can do with operating system technology today.
Okay, so that's transitive read-only. Now, case four is, and I'm going to come back to case three. Anything else, i.e., if you were to start this process, it would not be confined because it holds some initial capability and it does give it mutate authority to something. And the problem is, if I have mutate authority to something, we don't know who else has access to that something, so I can write it and somebody else can read it. And so there's no possibility of a guarantee of privacy. And the third case is actually the interesting one. We'd like not just to build one confined or private program, but actually to build entire subsystems that are confined. I'd like to start a program that is confined, but it in turn wants to rely on a second program that's also confined. So as long as the confinement is actually satisfied recursively, that's perfectly okay. And it turns out the constructor is able to recognize capabilities to other constructors using the authenticate operation. So as a special case, it allows a recursion that says, well, if you plug in a capability in a second constructor, and that constructor says, and that constructor is authentic, and that constructor in turn says, and the thing that I build is confined,
then we will treat that building capability, that requester capability of that constructor, we'll treat it as though it were confined, because the constructor is trusted to code. This lets us do recursive initialization. It's actually a very, very powerful thing. Finally, if the constructor actually builds a process, it installs into that process something that we call a brand. Kind of like a brand on a cow. I have a picture of a circular process with a Dell cow skin or something, a gateway cow skin. Maybe that wasn't such a great metaphor. This brand capability is a capability that is only available to the constructor itself. Nobody else can get it. Typically, it's just an unusual capability, a start capability to the constructor that the constructor doesn't hand out to you. But there's another operation of the discrim capability, which Norm Hardy named the can opener operation, and which we've renamed the identifying operation. So here's the idea. Can opener operation says, here's a process capability, or a start capability. And here's a capability that I think might be the brand capability for that process. I don't know. Might not be. Check. Compare my brand to the brand installed in the process. If and only if the two match, compare my brand and the brand in the process named by the start capability. If and only if the two brands match, return to me a process capability. Here's the intuition. If I can prove that I possess the brand, I have effectively proven that I'm the guy who created this process, because I have to be the constructor, because that's the only party who holds the brand. If I created the process, I have the right to tear it down. But a secondary consequence of this is, if a client application holds a process and wants to know, is this really a mumble version? You can go to a mumble constructor, and it can say, this thing here claims to be a mumble version. Did you create it? Because if you didn't create it, it isn't a mumble version. So I can authenticate programs. Now, this is hugely powerful, and this is hugely dangerous. The powerful part is, this means that I can write a program. I could be a database. And I have some front-end program. Right? It's an input validating program. I rely on it to check the integrity of data that's going to be put in the database. And here's the deal. That if, in fact, I'm talking to the integrity program, I'm willing to give it a capability to do lots of very powerful things in the database. And the reason that that's okay is I know what code the program runs. I know exactly what it's going to do with this capability. And that would mean I might be willing to let it do things that I would not be willing to let you do, even though you're a client of the program. Let me give a concrete example. Suppose the database we're talking about is a database that contains medical information. And there's certain information that you, whatever kind of user you are authorized to get. And other information that must not be disclosed to you, either for reasons of law or for reasons of ethics. So, I can't give you a capability in the database, because the capability in the database lets you read anything at all. I can only give you a capability to something that enforces this restriction, whatever that restriction may be. Maybe there's a checkbox somewhere that says, is the patient actually sick? And you're not entitled to know that. There's certain diseases for which we might imagine that would be problematic. So what I want, look, you have to use database for your job. You're a nurse, right? You've got to get patient records. You're entitled to know patient's name. What room is the patient in? Not, is the patient sick? Nurse is a bad example. Nurses actually need to know not only if you're sick, but what you're sick with. But there are other hospital staff who don't need to know. In the case of nurses, we actually need to know, are we speaking to your nurse? Which is a separate problem. So we need a way to build a program that implements this restriction, whatever the restriction is, and then we need a way to say, are we actually talking to an authorized program? Because if the program is not authorized, we can't let it have access to the database because we don't know what it will do. And the observation is that in the Unix system, the way we deal with this kind of problem, we ask, who is asking the question? And the answer is, maybe the nurse. Actually, the answer is somebody who logged in as a nurse. We don't really know who it is. So, the problem here is that the client program that the nurse executes has its authority because it's executed by the nurse, not because of any attribute of the client program. And in principle, a hospital nurse, could write a scripting program that would make all sorts of queries in the database that the nurse is not supposed to be able to get. And that the nurse is legitimately not supposed to be able to get. The problem here is what we actually needed to know was that the nurse's access was mediated. And in order to do that, we need to know something about the code that implements the mediation. We need to know that we're actually running that code. So we need to be able to authenticate applications. We also, it turns out, want to be able to do this on the basis of application instances, because there's a trickier problem. Suppose we have a sorting utility. Now, suppose we have a utility that implements something called a KSAM database. KSAM stands for Keyed Sequential Access Mechanisms. It's basically, it's a kind of a very simple database. You have records that have keys and data, and they're kept sorted. Now, a sorted collection of records is not in any way a privileged notion. There are lots of sorted collections of records in the world. Your phone book, my datebook, the school's grade database, the password file, all of these are things that if they got big enough, you might want to sort them. And some of them are sensitive, but notice their sensitivity is not because they're sorted, it's because of the content. So there are some of these record collections that are sensitive and others that are not. We actually need to be able to identify instances so that we can tell which one is which. It's not enough to know, yes, this application is running the record collection. We need to know, this application is running the record collection and it's the one that has access to the sensitive stuff. That's actually tricky because we're going to lose that information if we shut the system down. That's why it was persistent, which I talked about before. Let me now point out the dark side of authentication. Suppose I'm RIAA, the enemy who's been an enormous legal pain in the ass, but I really do something. I'm fond of assuming small children, at least they don't know it all. Now, if I'm RIAA, one could argue, and this is a long argument for a burger, but one could claim, and they do, that they have both a right and a duty to protect their intellectual property, which takes the form of music. And the way in which they want to protect that right is they want a mechanism. You want to play the music, they want to sell you the ability to play the music, so they want a mechanism that lets them send you music that you can play, but you can't duplicate it. Now, there's some technical questions about whether, in principle, this is possible. It does appear possible to say, well, you can duplicate it, but only by sticking a microphone up to the speaker, so at best you're going to get a degraded duplicate. That does appear just barely to be within the limits of possibility. Now, in order to implement that, though, they need to be able to put a driver on your system, and they need to be able to authenticate the driver because the game is, now let me switch to video, so the game is, I'm only going to send the high-definition video out to the television that I know implements the high-definition protection system. And the chain of trust is, or if you are on the other side there, the chain of treachery is, the driver is going to authenticate the television. The movie player is going to authenticate the driver. could shove any other driver you want in there. It can fully implement the driver protocol in exactly the right way, but the player will not believe that that is a trustworthy driver. So this technology, subject to a piece I'm about to add, is enough to do DRM. What I want to point out, though, for consideration, because this is a very, very problematic issue, DRM stands a good chance of destroying intellectual creativity across the world in the next 50 or 100 years, maybe faster. It's a fundamental violation of the social contract that's been working for 600 years. I'm not saying that we should not be protected. I'm saying they should not be protected forever. We gave people the right to a limited time period of protection in exchange for the agreement that the material would become public after a period of time. That time has been progressively extended. The fundamental purpose of DRM is to make sure that it never becomes usefully public. That's a violation of trust. But what I want to point out to you is, from a technology perspective, there's very little difference. In fact, I don't know that I can identify any difference between controlling your access to the movie or the song and controlling the nurse's access to the database. There are many ethical differences and many moral differences. But in each case, the fundamental enabling operator was, and required operator in each case, was the ability to say that data could only be moved through trusted programs. And you need that for both of those operations, and I am not aware of anybody who knows how to have one without admitting the possibility technically of the other. And there's an enormous fight going on in the Hood Group about this in the last few days. And all of us have been pretty tired and not entirely proud of some pieces of that fight. I want to close the microkernel discussion by switching gears entirely, apparently away from microkernels, although I'm going to connect these up. I want to talk for a minute about something called TCPA or TPM. TCPA is the Trusted Computer Platform Alliance. TPM is the Trusted Platform Module. So TPM is the hardware that implements TCPA. There are a couple of other labels in here, and all the various labels have merged, and this week's label changes every week, and I don't really care. You may have heard this discussed under the heading Palladium, which is an operating system that used this stuff, or ANGSCA, which was NGSCB, Next Generation Secure Computing Base, which was at one point a competitor to the TPM and the two of them merged. And the connection, just you see it coming, is TPM is not practical on large monolithic systems, and I'll explain why. It can be actually accomplished with microkernels with tremendous care. So here's what TPM does. Here's David. This is a feature that's now shipping in many machines, and it will be shipping universally in machines by new machines by the end of the year. And just to be clear, it's a feature that, as far as I know, the user has to turn on explicitly. And it's an interesting question whether users will. I suspect that they will. If it's turned on, that's a very important thing. By the way, once you turn it on, you can turn it off. Yeah.
You're saying by specification, OEMs are not allowed to ship it turned on?
I don't know what the specification says. Okay. I do know that if they ship it turned on, there's going to be a lot of very public embarrassment and anger. So if only for marketing reasons, I do not believe that it will ship turned on. I could be completely wrong, and I know Intel has been looking at this in connection with the next generation of the Vive technology. So be careful when you buy Vive labeled computers. But let me tell you what this does. And I can think of a variety of ways to beat it at about $10,000, but that's about what it costs and it requires hard-to-find expertise. When your machine powers up, it runs some early piece of your BIOS. Your BIOS goes to the TPM chip and it says, here's where I started running from. Here are all the bytes that this small initial piece of the BIOS is running. The TPM chip computes a cryptographic checksum. And inside the TPM chip, it has a series of registers that are used to compute progressively cryptographic checksums of each new state. So the first one is a cryptographic checksum of the bytes. The second one is a cryptographic checksum of the operating system plus the bytes. I skipped a bunch of steps because there's several steps involved in the bootstrap loader. And at each stage, the new checksum CN plus 1, right, is computed by taking the checksum of the N plus 1 stuff, so for example, the checksum of the code of the BIOS, convolved with whatever checksum you computed at the last stage. So there's a progressive chaining of checksums. And the upshot of it is, when this is all over, you get an unforgeable number that describes every piece of code that the system might have run from the time it was turned on to the time this number was computed. And by the way, generally speaking, this stops the operating system. So the goal is, have the hardware certify that we're running a trusted operating system and rely on the trusted operating system to implement the rest. Now, there are newer versions that have a more complicated story. I want to stick to the simpler story because it's already complicated enough. Yet.
Can you say a hash of the operating system? You're talking about drivers included?
Oh, yeah.
So, but anybody can write a driver?
No, in this system, they can write a driver. They can install the driver, but if they install the driver, the system will not certify them. There are two more questions. Because so far, we're not in trouble. So far, all we have is a number. We don't have any way to use it. The first part is something called secure storage. Secure storage is mostly a local feature. There's a very short list of registers on the TPM chip. Okay, and the deal is that if the checksum pairs of registers, and each pair of register has the form, here's the checksum, and here's the content. And the deal is, anybody can write one of these registers destroying the content. But you can only read them if the currently computed checksum matches. And the intention is that those content bits are going to be used to store a cryptographic key, probably one that is used to encrypt your disk. So the idea is I can install an operating system. The operating system can generate a cryptographic key. It can store it in the TPM store. This is a non-volatile store. It survives power off. And next time the operating system reboots, it can say, okay, I'm still the same operating system. Give me back my key. And then it can go and decrypt whatever it put on the disk. Or you can do a different operating system. Turn off Windows, which might use this, and turn on Linux, which for political reasons is unlikely to use this. Right? And Linux will go and say, give me back Windows key. And the TPM will say, you're not Windows. You don't get a Windows key. And if Windows has, in fact, encrypted content on the disk, the Linux system can read the bits, but it can't interpret them. Now, if you were concerned about theft, this is actually a very important thing. If you're concerned about guarding against reverse engineering, which businesses are concerned about when laptops are stolen, this is a useful feature. If you're concerned about unrestricted proliferation of other people's digital data, this is an important thing.
Does this have anything to do with how I've noticed a lot of Linux machines can't read any hidden files?
Hidden files are just Linux stupidity. They're not cryptographically protected.
Alright, I just noticed that if I have a file that's hidden on a Windows machine, and I take the CD and put it in a Linux machine, it can't find it. So
there are two reasons for that. They're both just bugs. One is that there are subtle differences on purpose in the CD formats that Linux will interpret and Windows will interpret. And that's actually intended as a feature, but it can have this consequence. The other is that the Linux implementations of Windows file systems are incomplete in some cases, and so that can be a cause. It's not, as far as I know, nobody's using cryptography for this. Certainly nobody's using this because the hardware is not universal. So the second piece. The second piece is something called attestation. This is the dangerous part. If I'm an outsider, you're a client, I'm a web server, you're talking to me, you want to buy into me. The attestation function enables the following to be added to the protocol. The web server can say, great, you want to buy music, I'm willing to sell you the music, but only if you can convince me that your software will enforce my contract to protect the music. You're a Linux user, you're out of luck. Probably. Maybe not, we'll see. The mechanism here, the web server says, prove to me that you're an OS I can trust. Now the OS can say, no! In which case, we're done. Or the OS can go to the TPM chip, and it can say, the checksum that you have most recently computed. Here is a one-time challenge nonce. It's a random set of bits that was supplied by the server. What I want you to do, I want you to take the checksum and the nonce together I want you to treat them as a message and I want you to attach a digital signature using a cryptographic key that is only accessible inside the TPM chip and cannot be forked. So what does this message mean? This message does not mean you have a bad operating system. What it means is your operating system has agreed to disclose to the server a very high confidence statement of what operating system you are in fact running. And the model is that the vendor is going to have a list of what operating systems they're willing to believe. And the question of drivers is well taken, because that's the actual flaw in this argument, that list may be millions of numbers long. Consider all the Windows upgrades that are partially incomplete. Right? And it's, two power of that. The vendor's going to have a list of numbers they're willing to sell to. And if you don't match one of those numbers, you're not going to get the music, or you're going to get the music downgraded. Question here?
Would it take just one escalation privilege in any of those operating system versions?
Yes, it would only take one security flaw to break this. And that's why it can't be done. Also, the system doesn't adequately check the hardware, and it doesn't look like that's an easy thing to do. So if I'm prepared to plug in the board the wrong way, I can circumvent this. The board has to be designed for that purpose. However, that's actually why I don't believe that this is practical with a system like Windows. There is simply too much code and there are too many vulnerabilities. If you go and look carefully at the planning design, what you discover is they're not planning to do this for Windows. The theory is that they're going to design a small microkernel that's going to sit underneath Windows or beside Windows. It's going to be protected from my hardware from Windows. And they're going to do this with a much smaller, much more easy to maintain, much more controlled piece of code than Windows could ever hope to be. Now, the missing link in this story is getting from the trusted operating system to that link that says you only have to talk to a trusted driver to process authentication. So when you combine this hardware mechanism with the constructor attestation mechanism, you've got an end-to-end enabled link that can, on the one hand, do DRM, right, in the middle position can do military security, which, depending on your perspective, might be a good thing or a bad thing, but on the other hand, can do medical and personal information privacy. You can't get one without the other two. So pick three or zero appears to be your position. That position could be wrong, and if so, that's something that we as a community urgently need to know, because this is a polarizing debate. And really looks like you can't have privacy without violation to culture. And that's a serious matter. Okay, so I wanted to finish that. Tomorrow I will take up exam review. I have to tell you, tomorrow I have to run out at 11 sharp.
and there will be no class on Wednesday. Excuse me. I'll ask Swarup to come to answer your questions, but there will certainly be no lecture and no review on Wednesday. Only one person has sent me a topic, so tomorrow is likely to be short.